Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits concept podcast. I am Chuck Anderson, and we have the special privilege of not only having our steady as a Timex, Andrew Dewhurst, with us. Andrew, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. Today, Chuck, how are you?
I am all right. Andrew, your Twitter moniker is?
At Andrew K. Dewhurst.
Okay, we also have our benevolent leader at FWFB with us. Benevolent leader. I don't know if that's is that high enough praise. We probably deserves more praise. But we have Justin Mason with us, one of the rising stars in the fantasy industry. Certainly adds an extra legitimacy to our existence. How are you today, Justin?
I'm hanging in there. About to go on vacation for a week, so figured I'd come on and harass you guys for an episode before I do that.
Well, Justin, you and I need to plan our vacations a little bit better because I'm not sure that we should be on vacation on the same week. But, you know, it's too late now. So
it works out perfectly. So people are just going to have to, you know, be okay with probably some sporadic pods next week, maybe a few less pods. But it's one less thing that Mike and Matt have to deal with in terms of doing all the behind-the-scenes work that I usually do.
Okay. Well, it'll. So maybe it does work out right. That's a very interesting point. I'm going to start out this show with a philosophical question directed at Andrew Dewhurst. If a podcast is recorded, but it's lost, it spirals into a digital black hole. If it's lost in the matrix, did the podcast ever exist at all? What do you think, Andrew?
It didn't. It couldn't have, because it's not a podcast until someone hears it.
All right. That's all I needed to know.
You guys are messing up here. The thing you need to say is it was the greatest podcast of all time, because there's no one there to confirm or deny that it wasn't.
Well, yeah. I mean, to be fair, it would have been, should it have made it out into the ether. But instead, you know, the world is now a lesser place because no one got to hear it.
Yeah. We just had a conversation. We just like to chat. That's what it kind of was last week, when out of nowhere we had sound issues that we have never had before. But the good news is that we have backup recording stuff going on today, so I certainly hope to be able to catch up for lost time. I also really, really like the concept for the week. What happened is I've gotten to the point where I'm sort of wondering if we've grown to achieve paralysis by over analysis. So the concept for today is that within the world of analytics, results don't matter anymore at all. What we traditionally consider to be results, wins, batting average, home runs, all the things, the actual fantasy line has gone by the wayside, because we no longer care what the fantasy line is. We care how the fantasy line was achieved more than the actual fantasy line. So all of a sudden, players that aren't really doing anything, but those peripherals look like they're going to be doing something soon, all of a sudden they get to the point where they're almost overvalued compared to players who are producing, which has got my mind completely boggled. And this is a really good concept episode for Justin to be on, because as usual, Justin will throw many opportunities for Justin to explain why I'm bonkers. So Justin, why don't you just fire away at me just being ludicrous? Go ahead.
I don't think the concept is necessarily ludicrous. I think results obviously matter, because that's what helps you win leagues. You know, a guy can have, you know, amazing underlying stats all season long, but just totally suck in reality in terms of the surface numbers, and you're going to finish last in your league. You know, and on the flip side, your guy could be just absolutely crushing it, and the underlying numbers don't support that it's going to continue. But hey, those are bankable stats. You're probably in first place right now if you own certain guys like Didi Gregorius, or, you know, I'm trying to think of guys who are maybe, you know, because I think some of what Gregorius is doing is legit, but obviously not to the level. You know, Dansby Swanson's one of those guys. Like, if you own Dansby Swanson, you've been starting him the entire way, like, your fantasy team is probably doing better than it should be. Does that mean it's going to continue? No. And I mean, the point of looking at underlying statistics is to see, one, is this stuff going to continue? Are guys like Dansby Swanson going to continue to hit 300? You know, is Didi Gregorius going to continue to hit for power? And that's what we try to use the underlying statistics to try to predict. You know, stats still matter because you've banked them. Does the fact that Didi Gregorius leads, you know, the American League and in Major League Baseball in home runs and RBIs at this point in the season matter for the next month now that he's done it for April? No, it means absolutely nothing unless there's some sort of proof to back it up.
Okay, the thing about this podcast is it allows me to be contrarian and reactionary, which is when I'm at one with myself anyway. Maybe it's not all that entertaining for you guys. I hope it is. But when I hear and see other fantasy analysts, what I get now is so much background statistics that I wonder if the players who don't have good underlying statistics and peripherals, if all of a sudden they're devalued just mentally. And I have an example that I want to throw at Andrew right away, and he can talk about the concept and then see if this example helps him understand it better. I think if you asked most people if they would have rather owned Corey Dickerson or Yoenis Cespedes for, you know, the first part of the season, most people would naturally think Cespedes. He's a, you know, he's a beast as far as exit velocities, and, you know, he's on a more exciting team than Corey Dickerson. But Corey Dickerson has been doing it. Like, Corey Dickerson is not batting below 200. You know, last I checked, Cespedes was. So how do you feel about this, Andrew? Do you think this is a good example of what's going on? And do you agree with us looking into this concept about peripherals maybe overtaking actual statistics?
Yeah, I mean, I see it two ways, right? We use, as Justin noted, like, we look at the numbers to try to be predictors of is what we're seeing for real or not. But there's also the flip side of it, where you also want to look for players who look like they're performing really poorly who really aren't, right? I mean, in terms of, you know, Cespedes versus Cedic, I mean, I don't... It wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility for Dickerson to finish the year with better numbers, and he will. I mean, that than Cespedes. It's not. I mean, it really at the end, it's very possible. But when we're looking at the numbers, I think your point ultimately is, you know, what I've actually done should matter more than what we think you will do. But ultimately, if you want to win at fantasy anything, you need to be able to understand what's for real and what's not, and to be able to predict who might be doing better than they should be and who's doing worse than they should be, so you understand who you should be acquiring and who you should be, you know, looking to fade.
I think we have so much information now that I think that may be easier said than done to know which improvements in which players are real and which aren't. And I also, you know, the contrarian players, like, you know, mentally I always think of Marco Estrada, because Marco Estrada got it done for three to four really good seasons without peripherally being able to understand why. Maybe Jay Happ is a better example right now, because we had defined Jay Happ as a non-strikeout pitcher, but he's developing over time as well. You know, I want to throw this concept at Justin. Almost every player in Major League Baseball is searching, is trying to sustain and trying to get better. You know, maybe the exceptions are, you know, Clayton Kershaw over the last, you know, four or five seasons. Like, it was hard to imagine him getting any better. Or Mike Trout. But the rest of the league, your average, your Major League baseball player average, your replacement level, your searching. So when something new happens and we see something, a skill that they haven't had before, like, how do we know if that's going to be sustainable or not sustainable? And do you think that you can do that through analytics? You can predict. Can you predict how predictive are analytics in and of themselves, Justin?
I think they're fairly predictive. I mean, there's obviously going to be outliers. You know, one of the guys that's kind of proving that maybe we don't know as much as we think we know right now is Paul DeJong. Like, he's a guy that, you know, the approach and the analytics say that last year should have been a fluke and that there should be some really hard regression coming his way. But so far, he not only is repeating kind of what he did last year, he's doing it, like, in the exact same way, where, like, you know, and in some ways even more aggressive than he did last year. But it's working for him. And so, you know, the more data you get on a guy, the more you're going to be able to use analytics. You know, and the younger guys or the guys who kind of pop out of nowhere are guys that you end up having to kind of learn as you go. But, I mean, we wouldn't be using these statistics and these underlying numbers if they weren't predictive of something and if they hadn't been tried out before. Of course, there's always going to be guys that either, you know, kind of bend the rules or are exceptions rather than the rule. But for the most part, you can look at these numbers and go, okay, this guy, he's swinging outside the zone a ton. You know, at some point that strikeout rate is going to start coming up and we're going to see that average tumble or the BABIP is going crazy. You know, there's not a whole lot of reasoning behind why, you know, certain guys have huge BABIPs. Well, then that's going to come back down to earth. You know, unless there's an approach change. You know, Brandon Belt, you know, you and I were talking about off air before we started. You know, Brandon Belt's a guy I've crapped on for a long time, but he made a real change in his swing, totally reworked his swing in the offseason. And now what's happening is he's having the breakout people have been looking for years, but he needed to make that swing change before the underlying statistics really kind of come through for him.
Yeah, I want to push listeners to know that there's a true benefit in understanding, you know, why these statistics get developed, you know, why there's a surge in a person's statistics. But you also have to be at one with the fact that all the variables can change back. There's reversion. There's, you know, you can revert back. I mean, different things can happen that, you know, the pitchers can adjust to the hitter, that you're going to get stuff out of it. You're going to understand things better. But you might not get reap all the rewards that you should. You know, I think that can happen as well. I just want to temper people in this new analytics age. Andrew, you have stuff to add here?
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I would add to this is that, like, what makes all of this really complicated is that, one, you need to understand, like, what all of the metrics actually mean. And the other thing that's possibly even more complicated is just time. Like, upon changing an approach, you know, what is, like, it's difficult at times to understand, like, what is the period of time at which the adjustment happens, and then, you know, you see a change, positive or negative, and then, you know, the pitch, like, then the league adjusts, and, like, you've got a lot of time periods that are just generally difficult to understand, right? So, I mean, you make an approach change for a batter, which leads to an approach change to a pitcher, and all that stuff takes time, and what it does is it, like, if you think of, like, the whole 162 games, right, if you broke it down into, like, 10-game pieces, like, trying to look at that, and that's why you start to see more and more graphs through the fantasy industry, is because it helps you see and understand time better through a graph, because it's hard to visualize and understand it in just a number as well. So, like, that's the thing about analytics. It's why, like, people get degrees in statistics and things like that, right? Because it's not some of it's easy to look at and say, like, out of, you know, when you look at a batting average, right? Like, we understand that when I look at the batting average, that, you know, that's a number that if you hit 250, that means out of, you know, 100 plate appearances, you're going to get on 25 of them, right? And extrapolate that out. But when you start getting into, you know, things like FIP and XFIP, and you start combining a whole bunch of numbers, and then you add in launch angle and understanding what that means for, you know, the rise or fall of somebody, you know, somebody's ability to hit a home run, or the modification of slug and getting into correlation of things, that's where, you know, the complexity comes in.
Yeah, well, it's all in good fun, because it's all around baseball, and baseball is just awesome. Easily the best sport in the world, not even close, in my mind, and I think probably in the mind of the panelists that we have today as well.
I'm a really big curling fan.
You are? Well, yeah, well, I could curl regularly here. There's a local curling club, and I have chosen not to yet, so maybe off-air you can convince me that I need to start sweeping a lot.
If there was a local curling club in Northern California, I'd be all over it.
There's a local curling club in every town here.
Yeah.
That does not stun me. Let's talk about some players, and we're going to put it sort of in this perspective. I think one of the most fascinating players over the last 2 years is Joey Gallo. Joey Gallo has an incredible amount of power, and he was not beloved by the fantasy industry. So I find this to be a very fascinating case study. What do you think about Joey Gallo? How do you think his relationship with analytics is now? Do you think people think he's going to be a good player going forward now that we've seen some incremental improvements, Justin?
It's interesting because I haven't had a chance to really sit down and watch Gallo play this year. But it feels like there is a little bit of a change in terms of what he's doing. I still haven't quite figured out what that is, because he is making a bunch more contact this year. And the swing and strike rate has gone down. But he still chases a ton of pitches outside of the zone. It shot up to over 37% this year, which is a little concerning. But overall, the strikeout rate has dropped to under 30%, which is a huge deal for a guy like Joey Gallo, especially because you consider you would expect the walk rate, which has been a little bit down this year, to come up and kind of bust up that OBP. You know, Gallo is one of those guys for me that fits into my strategy of punting batting average. And so, you know, he's a guy that I would typically end up on or with a lot of shares of. I did not as much this year, just because it just didn't fall to me in the way that I would have liked. I think Gallo is going to, I think he's going to be fine. And I think the amount of injuries we've seen on the Rangers is really just helping him solidify the playing time, scare that could have been had he continued to strike out at a 40% rate. But so far things are looking good, and he's, you know, got 8 home runs already. He's already notched stolen base, and there's no reason for the Rangers not to play him in what should be a lost season.
Andrew, how do you feel about our man Joey Gallo, who is regardless of, I know everyone says you don't like to see people strike out. Regardless of your opinion of Joey Gallo, Joey Gallo is entertaining. I think he's entertaining. I would rather watch a game with Joey Gallo in it than not with Joey Gallo in it, for sure. How do you feel about Joey Gallo, Andrew?
I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind when I look at Joey Gallo's stat line, at least initially, is I feel like the little Denny Green in my head pops up and says he is who he thought he was. Which, in fact, isn't, like, I think this year isn't true. I think we could be seeing potentially a really positive, like, I think we're seeing positive changes from Gallo. And one of the things that I think got more discounted than it should have was that he is just 24 years old right now, right? Like, I feel like the change in average and the lower, like, he's hitting the ball to all fields more equally right now. So last year he was like 50% pull, and this year he's just 30.6, which I think is making a big difference, because it's going to force teams to shift less against him, which will also probably force changes for the pitcher and how they pitch to him. I mean, he's still hitting the home runs just like we thought he would. His batting average is middling, which is just like we thought it would. But, I mean, he's a guy that I feel like his 250, although he had a 250 BABIP last year and he's got a 250 this year, I think we're going to see like positive improvement there, and we could see a 250, 260 average from him this year. And like if his ISO gets back up to what it was last year, you're going to see that, you know, 40 home run, you know, possibly 90 run, 90 RBI style year from him, that, which is what you thought you were buying at the time.
Well, it's curious you mentioned the BABIP, because I think I've almost never seen a more polarizing player. There's people who just it's like they want to be traditionalists and they want to say this is the kind of baseball player that probably wouldn't even made the majors, you know, 15 years ago.
He wouldn't have made the majors 15 years ago. I mean, he struck out almost 40% of the time last year. Like, I mean, 5 years ago, and this is the reason, like, he was like a top prospect for years, and then all of a sudden, you know, about 2 years ago, everybody just took him off the their prospect list because he wouldn't stop striking out like 35 to 40% of the time. But like now, that's acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, it's grown more acceptable, and I think you can look at Joey Gallo's stat line like Andrew did and say, you know what? There's room for improvement here. That 250 BABIP that he had last year is the lowest BABIP that he ever had at any level. And for a guy with this much power, he does not run poorly. He runs pretty well.
He's very athletic.
You know, and so it's hard for me to, you know, if we're going to look at this analytically, it's very difficult to look and say, well, 250, that's about what a guy like this is going to top out BABIP-wise. And yet he's still an outlier in so much as, you know, a lot of the time he does make hard contact is home runs. When the one thing I would say is Andrew Duhur said 40 home runs. He could see a 40 home run season. I think if it goes right and he has some hot streaks, we can see a 55 to 65 home run season, you know, with a little better BABIP luck, a little more back to the ISO that is traditionally him. And, you know, oddly, I think the oddest thing in the profile right now is that as the strikeout percentage has gone down, his walk rate has dipped some too. It's still a month and a little over a month worth of stats. But what do you think? What's the ceiling for home runs for Joey Gallo, Justin?
I mean, the absolute ceiling. I mean, dude could hit 70 home runs.
Like, I think 40 might be selling him short.
Well, I mean, like, if everything went right, I mean, we're talking about like a dream season. We're talking about a guy who has more power than just about every single person in the major leagues, you know, other than maybe, you know, Stanton and Judge. Like, this guy has legit power. The problem is, one, he has to make contact, and like, he's not a guy who has traditionally been able to make contact at elite levels in the major leagues. Now, he's not making contact at an elite level right now, but what he is doing is making huge improvements in his contact. He's got, you know, nine percentage point bump in his contact rate and an 8.5% bump in his zone contact rate, which means he is making good contact, and he's making contact within the zone and not just swinging, missing through everything. You know, the BABIP, you know, question, I do think the 250 is a bit low, especially considering how hard he hits the ball. And like Andrew mentioned, if he can actually go the other direction sometimes, that's going to make a huge difference for him, because teams won't be able to shift on him quite as much, and that would increase the BABIP level. You know, here's the thing with a guy like Gallo. A guy like Gallo is going to be extremely streaky. There's going to be weeks in which he hits four home runs, and then weeks in which he doesn't even have four hits. And so it's a matter of, will the Rangers stick with him in those cold times? What he's benefiting from right now is the fact that they're super banged up and they're unwilling to call up a guy like Willie Calhoun. But that may change here soon. You know, they may start getting healthy guys back. They've already started getting some of them. And, you know, the service time clock for Willie Calhoun is projected at May 8th, which means in about a week's time, a little over a week's time, Willie Calhoun should be up. That those kind of things could start eating into his playing time if he goes cold. And so, like, you know, obviously he's not going to hit 70 home runs, but would it surprise me to see him hit 45 this year? It wouldn't. And it wouldn't surprise me to see him hit 50.
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing that you're pointing to, and I get why you're pointing to it, I personally just think that the Rangers are what the Rangers are, meaning, you know, Adrian Beltre is not always going to be healthy anymore. I think that's pretty clear. You know, if they have any random amount of injuries otherwise, I just think that that team, I also think that they've bought in now. Now it's Joey Gallo. I mean, that's just who he is. He's part of the – I don't see them reducing his playing time. And they went through some really rough stretches last year. You mentioned him as streaky. Last year he had some streaks that were utterly abysmal. You know, barely having as many singles as home runs. I mean, you know, just really bad, some really bad stretches that they went through with the first year that they were really dinged up. I just think they're just going to be really dinged up at this point. And, you know, only time will tell that. That's hard to say. I am going to guess that the next player that we go to, that no one has ever gone from different level of star power or a different level of player as rapidly as we're going to right here. But there is a reason within this concept, and that is Junior Guerra, who is a 33-year-old right-hand pitcher from the Brewers, if you don't know him. He's on a really good stretch right now that I do not think the analytics people would like at all. And unfortunately, Andrew, we talked about in the Abyss podcast last week, we talked about him, and you get to talk about him again. How lucky are you?
Yeah.
What do you think about Junior Guerra, who now has a really good start against a red-hot Cubs team also under his belt?
Well, first, I want to just think of it. I like to only reference it as the greatest podcast of all time moving forward. But that being said, regression is still coming. He made it through another start. He pitched well against a good team. But, I mean, he's the ultimate guy. Maybe not the ultimate guy, but he's a pretty good example of this looks like a guy where regression is coming. Because, I mean, he's got a 8.59 K per 9. That's below league average. He's walking, you know, a little about 3.25 batters per 9, which is not fantastic. He's got a BABIP of 232, which isn't sustainable. He's got the ERA of 0.82 just is not going to stay. I mean, his xFIP is 4.26. That's almost four entire runs different. I mean, the reasons why it's not going to stay, he hasn't given up a home run yet. Unless he's made some massive pitch changes, that number's coming up. Obviously, he's going to give up a home run at some point in time, especially pitching at Miller Park. I mean, opponents are making contact 81% of the time. Like, just think about that for a minute. Like, if he only pitched five, like if he only threw five balls to the batter, more than 4 out of 5 times, they're hitting the ball in some manner. So, it's just not something that I think is sustainable. Not getting swinging strikes, getting those is just 8.5% of the time, which is like right now about 2.5% below average. His average is sitting nearly at 11% right now, which is also ridiculously high. So I just don't see it. I mean, as I think I talked about last week in the greatest podcast of all time, some guys do manage to outperform their peripherals. I mean, we talked about Sonny Gray doing it for years and then it eventually caught up to him. But I mean, right now, ride it while you can, but don't be surprised if, you know, he comes crashing back down to earth. And when he crashes down, he doesn't bounce a little bit when he hits it.
Justin, I picked up Junior Guerra in 3 leagues last week. That's how little anyone believes in Junior Guerra. I also want to point out that Junior Guerra's schedule was very soft before the Cubs start. I don't deny that for a second. But I am fascinated on what Justin thinks of Junior Guerra at this point.
I want to buy into virtually everything Andrew has said. And I do for the most part. And the one thing one of the things he didn't mention is he has the most ridiculous infield fly ball percentage I've ever seen. Which is a 28.6%.
That's fascinating.
So I do believe. Obviously, there's massive regression coming. I mean, this is a guy who he has a sub one ERA right now. He's walking over three batters per nine innings. The BABIP is low, but it's not like so low that I'm like that. I'm gonna point to that. And I think one of the reasons it's so low is, one, he's getting a lot of infield fly balls. He's also inducing a fair amount of soft contact and limiting hard contact fairly decently. And part of that is because the splitter he's using this year has been better. And his pitch mix has been a little bit better this year. So I think there are some reasons to his success. Do I think he can keep it up at this rate? No, but like even if he regresses all the way back to his xFIP, you know, that's a 4.26 ERA. Like that's not bad for a junior Guerra. Like especially
if you consider his draft position. Like if he got drafted at all.
Well, and I mean, in considering where we're at in this day and age in Major League Baseball, like if he can throw like a four ERA rest of the way, that's a pretty valuable pitcher in this day and age. Obviously, there's going to be massive blow-ups, and you're going to have to pick your starts very carefully with a guy like Guerra because there will be home run issues. He's had home run issues all throughout his career, and so it's not that I think he can sustain some of this. Maybe he can be the guy who was pretty good back in 2016. Maybe not to those levels, but I don't think he was the guy we saw last year. I think he was coming off an injury. I think he struggled coming back. I would say I would probably project him to be like a 4 ERA guy, with just under a strikeout an inning, which has value.
If I wanted to get ranty and ravey here, I could. I'm not going to put it that way, but I just, within the concept, I want to mention this. Okay? Everything that Andrew said about the negatives, I 100% see how they could be taken that way. But let me paint what he said differently and see if what you understand how I say that analytics can legitimize things either way. Okay? The 3.27 percent walk rate that he's 3.27 walks per nine that he has right now. Okay, you could look at that and say, you know what, he's not giving into hitters. Okay, his success is he's got a 0.82 ERA to this point. So if he's succeeding by allowing people to take a walk instead of giving in, then he's achieving something. It's not something that we're thinking, oh, that's necessarily a really bad thing. By the way, I mean, that 3.27 is actually pretty close to what his career norm is for it. Now, I also want to mention, when he got to the 4.26 xFIP, I haven't seen this before. I could ask Darius about it, and he'll probably go on for an hour. But his FIP is 2.77. So saying that, if you split the FIP and the xFIP, you have a guy who's a 3.5 ERA guy, which would be phenomenal for what every person listening out there has invested in Junior Guerra. So I think he's kind of, in his own way, he's a poster boy for what's going on. He's got kind of a semi-ridiculous strand rate that's well above his, above his career norm. But you'd expect that with a 0.82 ERA. And he's on a good enough team. They're not hitting right now. They didn't hit with the wind blowing in all weekend against the Cubs. But he's on a good enough team that you would think wins are quite conceivable. And he has the security. If he's pitching relatively well, their pitching staff isn't deep enough that he's going to get pushed out of the rotation. So there's just a lot of things that say, he should regress. No, I'm not saying he's going to pitch to some ridiculous 1.5 ERA. But if he pitches to a 3.4 ERA on the season, he could amass, 12 to 15 wins. And I think this is the poster boy for what I'm saying. It's so hard to necessarily analyze what's going on because you can say he should not be able to do these things, but somehow or another, he's doing them. So he's made improvements in areas that Justin pointed to. So I just think it's a fascinating case study.
Yeah, and I think the point I would make on that, Chuck, is that none of the things you said are potentially incorrect. But that's where advanced statistics are great, but nothing like using advanced statistics with the eye test is what I think mm-hmm. really makes the difference in the whole thing, right? Because that helps, like, if you were watching his starts and you can then discernibly say, like, okay, yeah, he's walking 3.25 guys, you know, for every 9 innings, but like, I watched him pitch. I know that that's not a sign of a control problem. That is a sign of him not giving him to batters. I mean, ultimately, you walk batters and it will come back to haunt you, and that's kind of an age, you know, a time-tested rule, but it does give you the understanding of, you know, putting the visual to what you're actually seeing, which is really what's valuable, right? Like, these numbers should really, at the end of the day, like, they're just giving you things to look for. Some of them are true and some of them are false and some of them are somewhere in between. But, you know, at the end of the day, we should not look at advanced statistics only. We should look at advanced statistics and statistics with the eye test. And, you know, how I like to look at them is it gives you a reason to watch the player, right? Like, you know, if you're looking at Junior Gary, and you're like, well, I don't know. Is any of this real? Let's go and watch a start, right? Go, if you got an MLB.TV subscription, go back and watch that start against the Cubs. What are you actually seeing?
Well, he looks junky, but I think part of the reason that he looks junky, which it might not be an adjective used this way very regularly, part of it is that, I mean, he doesn't throw all that hard. It's so weird watching the Brewers pitch right now because Zach Davies, Junior Guerra, and Yoli Chacin are all throwing various forms of junk. But they're all doing pretty well in their own way. And the advantage Garrett definitely has that split change thing that he throws that induces so many ground balls. That's the advantage that he has over those other two guys. Zach Davies' control has just been unreal so far this year, and I almost put him in instead of Junior Guerra, which we could have had the same discussion
but
about.
I mean, here's a big thing, though, for Guerra is, like, when last year when he really, really struggled with, you know, in his time with the Brewers before, you know, getting shipped down, he was throwing 92 miles an hour. His velocity's up this year. He's throwing 93, which is much closer than 94 we saw in 2016, and the 95 we saw in 2015. If he can gain a little bit of velocity as the season goes on and he's throwing 94, and most pitchers do, also, you know, his splitter velocity is up. And he's ditched out on the regular change, and the slider velocity is up. Like, you know, him being completely healthy is a big deal for him. Like I said, there's still regression. He's not going to win the Cy Young doing what he's doing, but I think he's a guy that could easily bounce back in a way that I don't think a lot of us expected him to.
Yeah, and you know, pitchers, of course, are notoriously difficult as far as, you know, having any predictive value on a regular basis. I do have another pitcher on the list, and this is probably the oddest player list that I've ever put together insofar as, you know, how these players exactly relate to the concept at hand. But I do find Wade Davis to be a very fascinating case study because no one was willing to push him into being like a top five closer. And I wonder if some of that is his relationship career-wise, in a way, to what Mark Melancon was. Meaning that, you know, we kind of started to question the underlying statistics, but he's getting it done. So you buy in, and then all of a sudden Melancon hit a cliff that we don't even know if he's ever going to come out of, which is unfortunate for the Giants and how much they're paying him for these the coming years. Sorry, I'm sorry about that. Sorry to have to mention that. But do you see my point that Wade Davis is a guy that, off of the peripherals, you want to say, boy, he's really regressing. But off of purely the numbers, you say, you know what? He's figuring out a way to get it done. And now Wade Davis has pitched really good so far for the Rockies. Moving to Colorado is another thing that just scares everybody. Oh, my God, he's pitching in Colorado now. I'm just curious where you are on Wade Davis and if you think we undervalued his actual production, Andrew.
Oh, I think we probably did. I own Wade Davis in a few leagues because of where Wade Davis went in drafts and that I did not grab closers really early. So I am greatly benefiting from being patient and grabbing guys like Wade Davis. Where I think, like, the things we have to remember about Colorado, right, is not just that it's a great hitter's environment, but some of the reasons why it's a great hitter's environment is that the change in the air at the altitude doesn't just affect how far balls fly, but it affects like things like curveballs and sliders because it causes them to not perform in the same manner. So a lot of cases, I think you see more hung curveballs and hung sliders in Colorado, which leads to some of these home runs and doubles and triples and so on and so forth with the increased slug and things like that. So it's why we have to understand when we look at pitchers like Wade Davis, like, can you be successful in Colorado? Well, you're throwing 47, like you're using your fastball 40% of the time and a cutter 32% of the time, which is basically a fastball. So 79% of the time you're throwing a fastball. So if you can be effective with those pitches, you can be successful. While his curveball picks up 20%, which it'd be interesting to look at that home road to see if there's a difference in mix. But, he looks like a guy that can perform in Colorado. His numbers so far look good and not out of the realm of sustainability, right? Like 11.12 K per nine looks pretty good. Down a run from, or down a strikeout from last year, but we're only at 11 innings. Walks are also down, which is all equally positive. BABIP is also way down, which is negative because it's going to come back up. But, Davis is performing, and it's something that you also have to account for is that Wade Davis has been performing to a good level for 5 years now. So, what reason do we have to not necessarily believe in Wade Davis?
Justin, did we undervalue Wade Davis going into this season?
No, we didn't. And if you are on March or on April 30th, you are patting yourself on the back for Wade Davis, you're a little bit too early on this one. The majority of his appearances have been on the road. And when he's been at home, he's not been very good. The Rockies played a lot of games on the road to start the season. There are going to be a lot more games at home as we move forward. And there's going to be some massive regression. He's currently got a 4.50 ERA at home. I would not say that is good. Not to mention, like, there was a drop-off last year in the second half. Like, the numbers were still decent, but he wasn't the same pitcher. He gave up more home runs. And this is a guy who has had serious injury issues in the past and things that have not necessarily been addressed. This is why Wade Davis went so low. Is it possible that he, pitches around these things, that he improves at home? Sure, but there are red flags, and if someone thinks that this is Wade Davis jumping back into the upper echelon of closers, I would sell right now.
See, and I would rather have Wade Davis and Kenley Jansen going forward.
That's insane.
I've got a trade for you then.
Yeah.
I only worry about saves when it comes to closers as a generality. And second of all, I want consistent, solid performance that looks like I just think there's something going on with Kenley Jansen, which doesn't mean that the other elite closers I wouldn't take over Wade Davis. But I just, there's just enough smoke, fuzz stuff going on. And I'm, you should like this, Justin. I have no belief in that Dodger team whatsoever.
Well, and last
year they would not make the playoffs, and I stick by my position. I stick right now by my position that the Dodgers will not be in the playoffs by the end of this season.
And I think you could be right. You know, one of the things I said on the most recent, or actually I think it was a episode last week of Sleeper in the Bus that I did with Paul Spohr, I said, like, is there a chance the Dodgers just aren't very good? And I think that there is some truth to that, but I think there's also, you know, they've been really injury riddled, and things have gotten, you know, even worse with Yasiel Puig getting hurt, you know, Rich Hill developing some sort of infection now in that broken nail that sent him to the DL, so he's not going to be activated today, and could miss some actual serious time now with this injury. So, I think there's lots of reasons to be concerned about the Dodgers in general. I think they'll rebound. I mean, they started off slow last year and ended up, you know, winning the National League. So the idea that they can't turn it around on a dime, I think it would be foolish. I do worry about Kenley, but like if you told me right now that I could get Kenley Jansen for Wade Davis, I'd do it in a heartbeat.
And I wouldn't do that. I would hold on to Wade Davis if I had him. I would not trade Wade Davis for Kenley Jansen right now, which is a difference in approach. And I mean, you know, like you said, he's struggled at home so far. Well, he's struggled at home so far over 11 innings total, and he's pitched more. So it's a really ultra small sample size. Basically, when he's given up a run, he's given it up at home to this point. You know, relatively, I believe those high scoring games and what have you, I think that leads to a decent amount of save opportunities, and I like it. So it's hard to say. It's a very dangerous prediction that I'm making on the Dodgers, let me say that, because their players, when things are going right, can be very good. I just wonder about the overall consistency of a lot of their players. We've seen a lot of streakiness out of Puig and Bellinger and, you know, all their pitching staff. Basically, we've seen a ton of streakiness out of. So if they all start to streak together, I'm going to look like an idiot. But I've looked like an idiot before. It just happens. Let's talk about a completely different type of guy, too, that you might probably wondering why I would even have on this concept. And that's one Chris Bryant. Chris Bryant, of course, recovered from taking a pitch to the face. Chris Bryant is one of the best hitters in baseball. And I don't think that the numbers always support exactly how good of a hitter Chris Bryant actually is. What do you think we should expect from Chris Bryant going forward? Do you think Chris Bryant is a player who, how do we judge, how do we value Chris Bryant when we know he's a better hitter than he's been at various stretches? What do you think, Andrew?
Well, I mean, to me, the value of him has not changed, right? Like, it's going to, like, production's going to be there. He's going to score the runs. I mean, as long as he's healthy, right? Like, I would assume at this point there's no lingering injuries from, you know, taking the pitch to the face. I mean, he should provide you with, you know, 30 to 40 home runs. He should, you know, score over 100 runs, provided the Cubs lineup, you know, things turn out as we expect them to. The RBI opportunity should be there to go with it. He walks at a, you know, at a 14% rate, which is great. He doesn't strike out. Like right now, he's walking and striking out at the exact same percentage, which is fantastic. He runs reasonably well, and he makes good contact. So, like, ultimately, this is a space where I think people want to say, like, you know, now's your time to try to buy Chris Bryant if anyone's willing to sell, which I don't think anyone is because it's, you know, April 30th. But, I mean, Chris Bryant's a great player, and if someone wants to sell him, you should buy him. And if you own him, you should just be patient because it's coming. I mean, don't worry about him only hitting 2 home runs so far. Don't worry about that stuff. It's going to come. Be patient.
So what do you think, Justin? Is Chris Bryant a better real-world player than he is a fantasy player?
I don't know about that. I think he is a guy that is still growing into what kind of hitter he's ultimately going to become long-term. And we're seeing some interesting, you know, underlying statistics this year that actually point to he's becoming a better hitter than he's been in the past. He's actually making more contact right now than he ever has at the major league level. He is swinging less outside of the zone than he ever has at the major league level. Swinging strike rate is down over 2%. Contact rate is at 83%, which is up from 77.7 last year. And inside the zone, he's making contact over 91% of the time. These are all things that tell me that we could actually see his average go up this year. And we could see him break 300 for the first time in the major leagues, even though right now his average is lower than it has been the previous two seasons. The one difference right now that you know that is a tad bit concerning for fantasy wise is we're not seeing him put the ball in the air quite as much as we're used to. His fly ball percentage is down 12% from last year. I'm not that worried about it. He's still hitting the ball hard. He's actually hitting it harder than he did last year. I think things are going to even themselves out as the season goes on and as things start to warm up in Wrigley. You're going to see him go pretty crazy, I think, offensively. I think this is a year in which, not that last year was bad by any stretch of the imagination. Dude hit 29 home runs, stole 7 bases, had 111 runs. But I think we'll see the numbers closer to the 2016 level where he almost hit 40 home runs.
Well, I think this is a case where the expectations were set just at an obnoxiously ridiculous level, meaning that he had a spring training where he hit, I don't know, 79 home runs or whatever it was. The point being is that we got the idea. I mean, I had the idea in my head that eventually Chris Bryant was going to hit 50 home runs. He was going to have a 50 home run season. I thought an elite top, you know, 3 to 5 fantasy player overall. And that's kind of not developed. But when I watch the Cubs, as much as I'm forced to, because, you know, I'm loath to do it, but I have to, being a fan of a team in their division, he is just a ridiculously tough out. And he's a presence when he's up at the plate. Like, you know you're going to get an unbelievable at bat, and he is likely in very, you know, high leverage situations, he is likely to drill the ball somewhere, and you're just praying that your defender happens to be there. And that's why I bookend him like that. Like, I think he's even a better player than what he is. I mean, do you think it's fair to say now, or do you think it's jumping the gun for me to say I was wrong in thinking he could eventually be the best player in fantasy? And I think maybe I was wrong in thinking he was ever going to hit 50 home runs. Quick answer, Chris Bryant ever hit 50 home runs, you think, Justin?
I think it's possible. I'm not going to say that it's not possible in with his level of power that I think is in that bat. I think it's unlikely.
Yeah, I tend to think so as well. And what do you think, Andrew? You think Chris Bryant will ever be a top 5 fantasy player?
I don't think he will without significant changes happening to the game. The reasons why I'm saying no is, one, Mike Trout's going to continue to likely be the best player in fantasy for an extended period of time. So that's like a guaranteed one right there. And I think with the scarcity of steals, you will continue to see players like Trey Turner sit really close to the front. So ultimately, I think you'll end up in a place where, like, Altuve's your most likely drop in the top 5 that probably went this year because of age and things like that. And I think Bryant's he's a guy that's going to give you a handful of steals and not much more. And I think that's going to limit him from being a top 5 fantasy player because of scarcity of steals, not because he's not an elite player.
All right. Well, I know they profile a little bit differently, but they're both infielders. Let me do it this way. Justin, for the next 3 years, if you had 3-year contracts in your fantasy league, for the next 3 years, would you rather have Manny Machado or Chris Bryant?
That's a really good question, especially because we don't know where Machado is going to end up after this year, considering he's a free agent. But I would assume he's going to end up in a place with a decent park. Man, that's tough. I'm gonna go Machado because he's going to be a shortstop. At least for next year is eligibility.
You agree, Andrew? Machado or Bryant for the next 3 years?
I would take Bryant. The reasoning being of location certainty. I don't see him going anywhere. He's not leaving Chicago in the next 3 years, I don't think. And you also, I feel like right now, and for the next 3 years, the Cubs are committed to winning. So there should continue to be a good lineup around him in that period of time. Whereas Machado, while I'm not certain that Machado wouldn't be willing to chase money and end up in a bad situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a level of possibility. This recent hot streak from Machado, I mean, I remember when he was a prospect and people were calling him Baby A-Rod, which was the sort of an ultimate compliment at the time. I would distinctly, and this is a change in pattern for me, I would say that it's Machado and it's not all that close for me, both because of the, you know, the chances that he's going to be shortstop and or third base eligible regularly. But also I'm starting to think that Machado is more willing to sell out for power, which we like more. You know, we just have a tendency to like it more within the game. I think Chris Bryant is probably the better player, which is a strong statement because Machado is an unbelievable defender on top of, you know, mm-hmm. on top of everything else he adds. But I just wonder fantasy wise, if it comes out that there's more upside, you know, we're comparing Cadillacs, but if there's more upside to Machado, which
I think especially if Machado ends up in an organization next year that will let him run more.
Yeah.
We're talking about a guy that is potentially like a 30-15 guy with a 300 average, which, like, there aren't many of those guys.
And I think the power upside between the two has gotten a lot closer in our minds over time, which, you know, the higher ground ball rate that you mentioned for Bryant. I don't think Bryant is selling out for power. I think if he was selling out for power, it might seem more attractive to us in some weird, demented way. One more player I want to talk about real quick here is Corey Seager. We're back on the Dodgers. He's a guy as well. He had a really strong rookie campaign, and now we're sort of floundering around and wondering exactly what he is. But the analytics side of it seems to say that Corey Seager is going to be nearly as good a player as we thought he was going to be. Where are you on Corey Seager right now, Andrew?
Corey Seager has not been my friend so far. As someone who owns him in TGFBI, he fell to me in the fourth round, and I thought, wow, I'm getting a real steal here, but that hasn't necessarily been the case so far. I mean, he's not doing, like, his underlying statistics don't look like there's necessarily a giant problem. Like, his, you know, the slug's down and the average down and the OBP are down, but like the walk percent's down like 1.3%, so it's marginal. He's striking out a lot less than he did last year. His ISO's down a bit, so that's a little bit concerning when you consider he only hit 22 home runs last year, so you may be going less on that number. And if the Dodgers overall continue to struggle, he might not reach league average in runs and RBIs, which means if he's not hitting around 300, man, that Corey Seager in the fourth round is a terrible choice. And that's ultimately where I'm sitting right now, is thinking, like, he's got some bust potential. It's all sitting there. I mean, from a he's not going the opposite. He hits mostly, you know, pull side, center field. He's not making as much hard contact, which isn't positive. So there's some reason to be concerned about Corey Seager. That's for sure.
Well, Justin, I'm going to frame this towards your biases as well. would you prefer D.D. Gregorius or Corey Seager going forward?
Well, for this year alone, it's D.D., and I don't think it's particularly close. I don't think Seager is healthy, and I think that, for me, is a really big reason why we haven't seen him reach the potential that a lot of people thought for him. And I think if we looked at his numbers based on what we think his based on, like, you know, kind of a blank name, if it was Corey Smith as opposed to Corey Seager, we probably wouldn't say this guy is necessarily a top 10 shortstop right now. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be very discouraged, and I think there needs to be some changes, you know, aside from the fact that I don't think he's healthy for him to take that next step. One, he doesn't run. Like, this is a guy who has never had, you know, more than, you know, 9 or 10 steals in a minor league season. In the majors, he's never had more than 4 stolen bases, and he had 4 last year. And the 20 home run power just doesn't play in the same way that it used to, a few years ago when he was coming up in a top prospect in the minor leagues. Ultimately, I do think he is hurt, and I think he's playing through injury. We've seen him miss a few games here and there because he's had back soreness, or certain things are nagging with him. And I think right now he's playing through injuries that are really sapping him from being able to do what he wants. When he does make contact, it's good contact, but he's really struggling right now to make exceptional contact, which is what he'll need if he wants to, you know, get back to 26 home runs that we saw in 2016. But even in that case, is that special? You know, we just talked about how this Dodgers team maybe isn't as good as we thought it was. Will the runs and RBIs be there like they've been in years past? Or is this a guy who's going to hit 280, 290 with 15 to 20 home runs and, you know, only have 85 to 90 runs or RBIs? Like, that's good, but Didi's playing in one of the best lineups in baseball in a fantastic park, which really plays to his left-handed swing. I don't think it's particularly close that I would take D.D. Gregorius over Seager.
How about Paul DeJong? Would you take DeJong over Seager?
Right now, I would.
Yeah. See, I mean, this is a pretty dramatic change from what we felt about Seager right after his rookie season. And after his rookie season, I mean, he went as like a top 15 player the next year.
Well, he was a top 3-round player this year, and it, like I said, like if he was Corey Smith as opposed to Corey Seager, like the prospect pedigree is what made him a 3rd-round pick.
Oh, absolutely. Andrew, you want to add in on our debate over where Seager is now?
I think if you're ultimately going to ask Justin a question of who he would take over Seager, I think the real one you have to ask here,
I know
it's obvious, is are you going to take Dansby Swanson over
Seager? I'm not taking Dansby Swanson over Seager.
Were you testing his anti-Dodger bias by being a Giants fan? No, I don't think that's particularly close. I'm not completely buying into Dansby Swanson. I think he's closer to what we thought he was, but there were optimists on Dansby Swanson that were nuts. There were people who, I think maybe just because of how high he got drafted in a weaker draft class, that thought Dansby Swanson was already going to be a top 10 shortstop right now.
I'm not convinced
he's ever going to be a top 10 shortstop.
No, he's not. And I'd like to point out that I know he started off really hot, but over the last 10 days, he's batting 171, 227, 195.
I'll put it this way. I think Dansby Swanson will be a top 10 shortstop if 20 other shortstops get hurt.
Well, I just want to mention that, that this is close enough and I need a little mental boosting right now, that I'm going to mention that I was once on a podcast with Todd Zola and our man Justin Mason preaching that I thought Ozzie Albies could be a top 10 second baseman. And Ozzie Albies probably should be the shortstop on that team. he's easily defender is.
No, I think Dansby's a better defender.
Oh, do you? Oh, that could be.
At shortstop,
that could be. But Albies, I think, could play shortstop at the major league level if he was in a different situation. Which, you know, at times I've drafted Albies thinking that if Swanson got hurt, maybe they would move Albies back there for a stretch of time and I could get dual eligibility, which I'm kind of an eligibility whore like that, as we all know. But I thought this was a fascinating podcast, and I really appreciate you guys' efforts in looking into these players with me. I do want to chart it going forward on exactly how crazy we get over falling in love with peripheral stats versus actual production. And we delved very deeply into it today, which I really liked. Justin, since we don't have a whole lot of time, why don't you give us a quarter of the stuff that you're working on, since it's an amazing amount of stuff, and remind us where you can be reached if there's any. But I don't. Maybe there's nobody out there who follows baseball who doesn't follow you already on Twitter. But perhaps you should give them your moniker anyway.
Yeah, you can reach me on Twitter at Justin Mason FWFB. You can either listen or read all my stuff at FanGraphs, FanTracks, Fantasy Alarm, and FNTSY, and of course, Friends of Fantasy Benefits.
Just because I haven't heard you mentioned, are you still been on XM Radio regularly, Justin?
No, I'm on Fantasy Sports Radio.
Fantasy Sports Radio, maybe that's
yeah. Every Sunday, you can catch me on the Tout Wars Hour, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern.
Okay, because then it was Sirius Radio at one point, was it not? Is that what I'm thinking of? Or you were just cameos? Is there an outlet in the United States that you have not been on that involves fantasy baseball? Do you think there is?
I don't believe I've been a part of anything Yahoo or ESPN, but I'm open to coming on those if they want me.
Just to add to the already impressive name brand. But thank you so much for your time today, Justin, as well, for being with us. We enjoy it a great deal, obviously. Andrew, how about you? Now hockey season, you're in playoff mode. I don't know. Do you any fantasy playoff hockey? Because that would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, I'm not. Unfortunately, well, I don't know if it's that unfortunate, but you know, regular season ends for playoff for fantasy hockey pretty close to the time that that baseball season starts up. So juggling two sports at the same time is more difficult than I thought it might be, and keeping different metrics and stats and growth and all that stuff straight. Essentially right now, I am building a database of baseball statistics. So I'm tweeting out various things that I think are interesting that are happening there. Kind of finding that to see what I can learn from it. Starting up the Daniel Robertson bandwagon, if anyone wants to hop on. I wrote about that last week, and continuing to push that forward as he's been white hot, and I'm looking to see what this guy is really going to be. And, you know, talking to you guys every Monday about, you know, these concepts. So,
You know, don't sell yourself short, sir, because you're a devoted family man on top of it, and you obviously do a lot of your job as well. So you're doing great stuff, giving us a slice of your ample intelligence, sir. We appreciate it. I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at just Chucking It on Twitter. I try to be very interactive, as many of the staff members at FWFB do as well. So thanks so much for the time. This was a concept podcast, and it is an ever-changing analytics world that we're going through now, and I'm here to react to it, and fortunately for me, I got smart people to help explain what's going on, which we appreciate. This is the FWFB concept podcast, signing off.